Good morning, everyone. We are reading in Book 1, the Book of Beginnings, Canto 5, the Yoga of the Spirit's Freedom and Greatness. And we reached page 79. I think we stopped on line 188. We'll read on from line 199 on page 79. The line is, aware of his occult, omnipotent source. This is King Aswapati, his soul retired from all that he had done. He sees the littleness and pettiness of human life, and his soul decides that this is not at all what it needs or wants. It has to withdraw and seek for something else. And then he has this experience of a golden influx flowing through heart and brain, a force coming down into the mortal limbs, into the body, current from eternal seas of bliss. He felt the invasion and the nameless joy. We'll read on from there. Will you start, Luba, please?
Aware of his occult, omnipotent source, allured by the omniscient ecstasy, a living center of the illimitable, widened to equate with the world's circumference, he turned to his immense spiritual feet, abandoned on a canvas of torn air, a picture lost in far and fading streaks. The earth nature's summits sank below his feet. He climbed to meet the infinite moon above. The immobile ocean silence saw him pass, an arrow leaping through eternity, suddenly shot from the dense ball of time, a ray returning to its parent sun. Opponent of that glory of escape, the blank incursion swung its dragon tail, lashing a slumberous infinite by its force into the deep obscurities of form. Death lay beneath him like a gate of sleep. One pointed to the immaculate delight, questing for hope as for a splendid prey. He mounted, burning like a cone of fire.
Thank you. Perhaps last week we discussed this first sentence, wakened to equate with the world's circumference. A living center of the illimitable. I think we talked about those two lines. So King Aswapati is leaving behind the earth nature. He turned to his immense spiritual fate. And Sri Aurobindo somehow describes him as taking off like a rocket, like a firework or launching a spaceship. No? The earth nature, the very highest levels of the earth nature, sank below his feet. Picture, like a picture painted on canvas, and the canvas has been torn, abandoned on a canvas of torn air. A picture lost in far and fading streaks. The earth nature's summits sank below his feet. He climbed to meet the infinite more above, all the higher levels of consciousness above the earth nature. And Sri Aurobindo describes him shooting through eternity, an arrow leaping through eternity, suddenly shot from the tense bow of time, as if he's been let loose suddenly. He is a ray of the supreme sun returning to its parent sun. And there's a reaction to that immense release. Opponent of that glory of escape, the black inconscient swung its dragon tail. Several times we come across this description of the dragon of the dark foundations, the dragon of the inconscient. So now it's lashing its tail in fury as King Aswapati takes off. No? And that movement, strong movement of the inconscient, lashes a slumberous infinite, the lower infinite, which is in a state of trance or sleep. With this movement of the dragon's tail, it gets lashed into the deep obscurities of form. Things happen in matter at that moment. And he sees death, the state of mortality, lying beneath him like a gate of sleep. And he is one-pointed to that immaculate delight, that pure divine delight which he has perceived. He's questing like a hunting dog, but he's pointed exactly at his target, questing for God as for a splendid prey. He mounted, burning like a cone of fire. So Mother has asked Huta to make a painting like a cone of fire shooting off through space. That is King Aswapati. Now Sri Aurobindo will make a more general statement. And more. Yes.
Does this mean that when he's going, he's ascend, the dark forces got awakened?
Things got stirred up on Earth.
As a reaction of he's going to the light.
Yes.
So this comes to the matter, makes darkness in the matter. This is what it
means. Yes, something in matter gets moved and affected. It was immobile and asleep. But through this, there's some movement. Sri Aurobindo doesn't tell us exactly what the effects of that movement are, but he speaks of new forms being created or emerging. Shall we go on? Yeah.
To a few is given that godlike rare release, one among many thousands, never touched, engrossed in the external world's design, is chosen by a secret witness eye and driven by a pointing hand of light across his soul's unmapped immensity. A pilgrim of the everlasting truth, our measures cannot hold his measureless mind. He has turned from the voices of the narrow realm and left the little lane of human time. In the hushed precincts of a vaster plan, he treads the vestibules of the unseen, or listens, following a bodiless guide, to a lonely cry in boundless vacancy.
Thank you. Anybody would like to ask anything? So this is not only King Aswapati. This can happen to other beings, only a very few of them. But it can happen, that godlike, rare release from human limitations is given to one among many thousands never touched. All those many thousands who are engrossed, fully focused on the external world's design. If you're engrossed, all your attention is given to the book you are reading or the film you are watching. You're not aware of anything else. No. But one among many thousands is chosen. There's an eye watching above, chooses that one. And then he's driven as if by a pointing hand of light, saying that way. He's driven across his soul's unmapped immensitudes, the vast space's own soul, the unlimited vastness of the soul, which hasn't been mapped. He becomes a pilgrim of the everlasting truth. That's where he's heading for. Our human measures can no longer hold his mind. It's become vast, measureless. He's turned away from the voices of this narrow realm where we live, left the little lane of human time. He's walking as if in a vast temple, precincts. It's a word that we use for the territory, the premises of a temple. And the precincts are defined by walls, by enclosures. No? In that vaster plan, there is silence. It's very, very quiet. He's treading the vestibules of the unseen. The vestibule is a small room at the entrance of the house where you can take off your shoes and your raincoat and your hat and move in to the...
Yeah, they burnt the fire dedicated to Vesta, the house spirit.
Yes.
Vesta vestibulum.
Oh, Vesta. Mm-hmm. Thought it's where you take off your vestments, your outer clothes also.
Yeah. Chamber also, yeah, small vestibule.
Yeah, exactly, yes. Here is Anandi approaching through the vestibule. So either he's passing through those antechambers of the unseen, or he's moved on further. He listens, he's following a sound, a lonely cry in boundless vacancy. There's an invitation, a call, which is guiding him on his pilgrimage. Don, you would read?
His soul left.
Wait a moment. All the deep cosmic...
All the deep cosmic murmur falling still. He lives in the hush before the world was born. His soul left naked to the timeless one. Far from compulsion of created things, thought and its shadowy idols disappear. The molds of form and person are undone. The ineffable wideness knows him for its own, a lone forerunner of the godhood earth, among the symbols of yet unshaped things, watched by closed eyes, mute faces of the unborn, he journeys to meet the incommunicable, hearing the echo of his single steps in the eternal courts of solitude. A nameless marvel fills the motionless hour. His spirit mingles with eternity's heart and bears the silence.
It's as if he goes beyond the universe, this one. He can no longer hear that deep cosmic murmur, all the movement of the universe. He lives in the hush, in the silence, before the world was born. It's beyond our time and space. And his soul has no covering. It's fully exposed to the timeless one. He's moved very far from the compulsion of created things, all the laws of nature, all the laws of consequence. Thought and its shadowy idols disappear. All the forms, molds of form and person, they're all dissolved. The ineffable wideness knows him for its own. He belongs to that vastness beyond the universe, the manifested universe. And Sri Aurobindo describes him as a forerunner. He's taking a path that others will follow, a lone forerunner of our earth, which is moving towards its divine fulfillment. So he's moving through symbols of yet unshaped things, things that have not yet manifested. He's being watched as he moves by the closed eyes and silent faces of the unborn beings who have not yet taken form. He's journeying to meet the incommunicable, about whom nothing can be shared or said. He hears the echo of his own step in those eternal courts of solitude. A nameless marvel fills the motionless hours. There seems to be some time, but it doesn't move. His spirit mingles with eternity's heart and bears the silence of the infinite. That is a general description. These experiences will meet any of those few who are chosen to undertake this pilgrimage.
I have a question, I think a general question. I have a question, I think a general question. It's about line 210, and what's coming after that? Too few is given that godlike rare release. That's line 210.
Yes.
And my question is now, does Sri Aurobindo not say at the same time that if we do the things we have to do, we can reach that state also?
He implies something like that, that this can happen to a few. But in the next line, he does say that those few are chosen. Maybe not everybody is chosen. And how we can qualify ourselves to be chosen, he doesn't go into detail about that here. It's that idea that perhaps you can't choose yourself. No? You're chosen by a higher power, and then you're driven on that path. But of course, we've been shown King Asvapati how he was destined for this. He's been given the preparation and the experiences, and this is what he's come to earth. That's what he's come to earth to do. But at least this is not a unique case, no? It may be for only a very few, but still for a few it is given. And these few are forerunners then. These are forerunners going ahead of the movement of the earth.
But
he's a lone forerunner. At the moment he's alone, yes.
He's not alone. I'm curious to know, watched by the closed eyes, mute faces of the unborn.
Yeah. He's moving into the future, to the things that haven't been manifested yet, that are waiting to be born, come into the universe.
I saw this kind of gods, maybe, or some sages who's watching his journey.
I don't think it is that. Because he's a forerunner, he's going ahead of the material manifestation, and these possibilities are there, waiting, watching.
Here he says the next line, 211. One among many thousands instead of one among many millions.
That's right, yes.
Later on, he's going to be very.
Have we read the next section? I think so, no?
Yeah.
So, yes. So we can go ahead, please.
In a divine retreat from mortal thought, in a prodigious gesture of suicide, his being towered into pathless heights, naked of its vesture of humanity. As thus it rose to meet him bare and pure, a strong descent leaped down, a might, a flame, a beauty half visible with deathless eyes, a violent ecstasy, a sweetness dire, enveloped him with its stupendous limbs, and penetrated nerve and heart and brain, that thrilled and fainted with the epiphany, his nature shuddered in the unknown's grasp. In a moment shorter than death, longer than time, by a power more ruthless than love, happier than heaven, taken sovereignly into eternal arms, hailed and coerced by a stark absolute bliss, in a whirlwind circuit of delight and force, hurried into unimaginable depths, upborne into immeasurable heights, it was torn out of its mortality, and underwent a new and boundless change.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. So first there's an ascent, this divine retreat from mortal thought. His being towers up, going up, as we have seen, like a rocket, and it's leaving behind its vesture, its clothing, its covering of humanity. It's questing for the delight, no? One pointed to the immaculate delight, questing for God as for a splendid prey. He mounted, burning like a cone of fire. So as his being surges up out of its human limitations, as thus it rose, then a strong descent leaps down to meet him, a might, a flame, a beauty half visible with deathless eyes, a violent ecstasy, a sweetness dire, something so intense, it's terrible, enveloped him with its stupendous limbs and penetrated nerve and heart and brain that thrilled and fainted with the epiphany, with this revelation of the divine presence. His nature shuddered in the unknown's grasp. And this descent brings about a transformation. In a moment shorter than death, longer than time, by a power more ruthless than love, happier than heaven, taken sovereignly into eternal arms, hailed and coerced by a stark absolute bliss, in a whirlwind circuit of delight and force, hurried into unimaginable depths, upborne into immeasurable heights, it was torn out from its mortality and underwent a new and bornless change, a limitless change. This is the second transformation that we've seen Aswapati undergo. The first came at the end of Canto 3 on page 44. It's described on page 43 at the bottom, and on page 44 we see, thus came his soul's release from ignorance, his mind and body's first spiritual change. And that change was already a very great change, which enabled him to connect with the universal strengths and to fill Earth's smallness with their boundless breaths. He could draw the energies that transmute an age.
Sure, this is the beginning of the transformation, no? And this possibly is the end, this second part.
There are, I think, totally four transformations described. In Sri Aurobindo's yoga, he speaks about three. And we will see those three very clearly in the case of Savitri. But it's interesting to see also the transformations that Aswapati undergoes. And each time we see that it is not he who transforms himself. He is transformed. So this here, a great presence. It's not named. We are not told who is this beauty, dire, sweetness, dire, this might, this flame. But that presence takes him, coerces him, takes him by force.
It's very strong.
It's extremely strong, yes.
Dire.
It's almost unbearable.
Yeah, that's what it feels like.
It's torn out from its mortality, its human state, subject to death and ignorance.
Mm.
Mm.
What is the power that's more useless than
exactly
love?
The same question.
Well, as I was just saying, Sri Aurobindo hasn't named it, so I'm not going to name it.
No.
We can focus on that, and as we go through the poem, we can maybe get an idea what kind of label we might put on it. But for now, I think I won't do that.
It's always the opposite, because happier than heaven.
Yeah.
It's like also is fantastic.
Ruthless means it has no pity, is it?
And love power, it is like something ruthless in love. It is.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah, so love can just seize hold of you, and it's quite pitiless, no? It doesn't leave you much choice.
It is a strange word, though, to use in this context, kind of.
Yeah, well, I think what he's doing is emphasizing the extremes and the intensities
yes.
of this experience.
Because ruthless is associated with cruelty.
Yes.
Ruthlessness, ruthless.
Ruthless means pitiless.
Must be done for your own sake. It's a very negative word.
So we'll see Sri Aurobindo doing this throughout the poem, taking words which for us are negative and giving them a different turn.
It's like a stone kind of impact.
Yes.
No, it gives like
I think this word is correct.
Yeah.
Surely.
I know what he's talking about.
You know what
he's talking about. Travis is talking that
makes it
complicated.
Somebody's speaking, don't
I'm so sorry.
Yes.
Oh, no, I think this is correct, because when the power starts, you know, there's taking you and you really think it's you're dying.
Yes.
You
maybe
think
it's
what's going on with me.
Yeah.
It's not anymore love, but it's love, because
yes.
it cracks you
Mahakali
up
Mahakali
of the whole thing.
Exactly.
This is correct. This is absolutely correct, I think.
It always is. He uses the inevitable word.
Yeah.
Throughout these 24,000 lines, he has paid great attention.
Mm-hmm.
That was his effort, writing and rewriting again and again and again, always to find, he called it the inevitable word, the one word that really expresses it. Even if to us it seems difficult to understand, well, that's a challenge to our understanding, isn't it? What did you want to say, Don?
Well, this dictionary describes ruthless as we know it,
yeah.
without compassion, pity, or sorrow.
Yes.
It may be the power of transformation.
How good what I feel with ruthless is love is divine grace. Divine grace doesn't
allow you any alternatives.
for your good sake, that you personally can interpret it as very negative, but it's for your best. In that case, ruthless. It doesn't consider your desire, it's the divine that you are taking to. In that sense, and the divine loves you, so the grace is much stronger. It's equivalent to the sincerity of your aspiration.
Mm-hmm. You can
that, and he's taken by that, I think.
In Greek mythology, there are stories, no? Of the gods coming down and just getting hold of people. And carrying them off. It's as a rape. It's called the rape of Ganymede or of somebody else. No, they have no choice. They're just carried away. But in a way, as Duan says, it is the grace to be seized and carried off,
yes.
raped into rapture by
raped
the divine.
Firefighter walks inside, and there is a child who is fearful of the whole thing. And the firefighter would be ruthless to take the
child
and pull through the window. He knows very well there is a
somebody
there.
To get him.
There you cannot be kind as well when you are ruthless.
Yes, right, something like that. Also, I wanted to say that all these words that Sri Aurobindo is using, we can see them like the artist adding a brushstroke of color here and here and here, and it's the overall effect. Each one is contributing something, even if, and similarly with a musician, a composer, he will be adding notes, sometimes they might seem discordant and you wonder, what's that? You know, the ear wonders, but they add up to something. That's what Schopenhauer's doing here.
In poetry, it's very normal to use this kind of opposition words to make you feel more than what the author wants to say. It's quite normal.
And Sri Aurobindo does that a lot because he says, thought buffeted awakes and grows created. Sorry?
Exuberance, which is the word ruthless, the sweet, dire.
These are, well, they're all adjectives. Did you want to say oxymoron?
Yes.
Apparently contradictory, paradoxical. But in fact, it's just widening our minds and our appreciation to see that these opposites can enhance each other. Yes, exactly.
Their own thoughts and affirmations, they are very much.
Yes, right. So the result of all that is a new and bornless change in Asvapati's nature, not just in his consciousness. In his nature. This is a transformation, a realization. Shall we read on? Would you read, please?
An omniscient knowing without sight or thought, an indecipherable omnipotence, a mystic form that could contain the worlds, yet make one human breast its passionate shrine, drew him out of his seeking loneliness into the magnitudes of God's embrace. I annuls the hours, abolishing the agent and the act. So now his spirit shone out wide, blank, pure. His wakened mind became an empty slate on which the universal and soul could write. All that represses our fallen consciousness was taken from him like a forgotten load. A fire that seemed the body of a god consumed the limiting figures of the past and made large room for a new self to live. Eternity's contact broke the molds of sense. A greater force than the earthly held his limbs. Huge workings bared his undiscovered sheaths. Strange energies wrought and screamed. Tremendous hands unwound the cord of mind and freed the heavenly whiteness of a Godhead's gaze.
Thank you. This being, this might and flame and beauty and ecstasy and sweetness, this is personal. It's omniscient and it's omnipotent, but it does have a form, a mystic form that could contain the worlds, and yet it could also inhabit, it could make one human breast its passionate shrine, personal presence, not purely impersonal. And this drew him out of this seeking loneliness, this state that he has been in all alone, lone forerunner of the Godward earth. He's welcomed by this embrace of the divine. And then the effect of that experience is described.
What does soul mean in line 271, universal and soul could write?
Well, the one is the soul, the one without a second. But that one, that transcendent one, is also the cosmic spirit, the universal. And he's also the individual soul. So, but here it is that the transcendent one and the universal spirit can write things on that empty slate of Asvapati's consciousness. I think this word represses that comes in the next line, it also came at the end of Canto 3. There he says suppressed, all now suppressed in us began to emerge. Well, here it is that everything that represses our fallen consciousness is just taken away from him like a forgotten load, a load falling off, and it's just gone. It seems perfectly natural that it should be gone. And then there's this fire, this Agni force, seeing the body of a god, it just burns up all the limiting figures of the past and makes a lot of room, a large room, for a new self to live. All the old limitations and habits and things that we're attached to. Contact with eternity, with the transcendent, broke the molds of sense. Everything that we, all the information we receive through our senses is molded. It's in familiar patterns, so that we immediately respond to these touches with recognition. But all that is being taken away, those limiting molds of sense, from Aswapati. A greater force than the earthly held his limbs. This is not earthly material life energy that's holding his life, his body. And huge workings bear his undiscovered sheaths. We don't have only have a physical sheath, we have a subtle physical sheath and a life sheath, like perhaps several mind sheaths. No? So now that he's no longer limited by this earthly force, these undiscovered sheaths, these subtle bodies are revealed. Strange energies that he's not used to worked and screened tremendous hands, unwound the triple cord of mind and freed the heavenly wideness of a Godhead's gaze. I think that Nolini Kantagupta has given a talk or written a small essay about this triple cord of mind. It's a Vedic idea that all we individual beings in the world, we are tied to this earthly existence by this cord, which has three strands of physical, vital, and mental. And when that is unwound, then we are no longer this animal tied to the sacrificial post or enclosed in the sacred enclosure. The being becomes free. So this sets free in Aswapati, the heavenly wideness of a Godhead, power of vision and perception, which is that of a divine, immortal being. Ananda, you'll read.
To address the world shape is sin. They are reached through forms to the hidden absolute, the cosmic feeling of transcendent sight. Increased and heightened were the instruments. Illusion lost her grandest invention. As from her failed hand, the measures fell. Tomic looked the things that loom so large. The little ego's ring could join no more. In the enormous spaces of the self, the body now seemed only a wandering shell. His mind, the many frescoes out of court of an imperishable inhabitant. His spirit breath is Superman. Superhuman.
Thank you. Stop there, please. Yes. So with this heavenly wideness of a Godhead's gaze, it's as if he can look through the surface, the form, and see the inhabitant who is wearing this form, a different kind of sense, cosmic feeling, a transcendent sight. Can perceive the wearer's form, the hidden absolute. And all the instruments of the being are given greater power and intensity. They're increased and they are heightened, they're made more sensitive, given a greater intensity. Power of illusion lost its aggrandizing lens. She has a magnifying glass. She makes little things seem very big and important. But now, as from her failing hand, the measures fell, atomic looked the things that loomed so large. This happens to us often. No? Small details seem incredibly important and troublesome, but when the true sight is there, they're seen for their smallness. So this limiting ring of the ego, which is so important to us up to this stage in our development, now it's opened. It can't close anymore. There's a way out. It's not the end of the ego, that comes a little later, but it's no longer so powerful. And that changes his own self-perception. Now he feels the enormous spaces of his self. The body now seemed only a wandering, empty shell. The real being is much, much vaster than the body. And the mind, it's no longer these glasses that we look through. It's also much vaster. It seems like the outer courtyard, beautifully decorated with many, many different images, but inhabiting it is something else, an imperishable inhabitant. These are the perceptions of the self, and his spirit takes a deeper breath. It breathes a superhuman air. Daniel, read.
The imprisoned deity rent its magic fence, as with a sound of thunder and of seas. Vast barriers crashed around the huge escape, immutably corbel with the world, circle and end of every hope and toil, inexorably drawn round thought and act, the fixed, immovable peripheries effaced themselves beneath of incarnate street, the dire fellow man and the bottomless crypt, between which life and thought forever move, forbidden still no cross the dim drowns. The guardian darknesses mute and formidable, empowered to circumscribe the wingless spirit in the boundaries of mind and ignorance, protecting no more a dual eternity, vanished, rescinding their enormous role. Once figure of creation's swaying ellipse, the expanding zero lost its giant curve.
Thank you. This is rather a difficult passage, isn't it? With this liberation into the wideness of a Godhead's gaze, then the imprisoned deity, the divine being imprisoned within the human nature, tore apart its magic fence, this fence that keeps the sacrificial animal confined. And these barriers that crash down with a sound of thunder and roaring seas, vast barriers crashed around that huge escape as the imprisoned deity tore apart its magic fence. It seems there are some fixed, immovable peripheries, boundaries, that are unchangeably coeval with the world. Co-evil, it means they last as long as the world lasts. Came into existence when the world came into existence. They're there, they won't change as long as the world lasts. He later describes it as an expanding zero, a huge circle. They are circle and end of every hope and toil. They are inexorably drawn around thought and act.
I can't understand this line.
Yeah, that line, those peripheries have been drawn around, and inexorably, it's like ruthless, pitilessly, then, and they are not going to be changed. Something that's somebody who's inexorable, he gives his decision, and nothing can change it. But now they are effaced. They're just wiped out, these fixed, immovable peripheries. Effaced themselves. beneath tread of the incarnate divine. Nothing can resist his tread. They just disappear.
By their own will, that can be. Nothing destroys them, they take themselves out.
Efface themselves. They just disappear. And then he says, there's a dire velamen and a bottomless crypt between which life and thought forever move. A velamen is a veil. It's usually the sacred veil. For example, in the Jewish temple, there was a velamen, and the ark was kept behind that, this veil, which ordinary people are not allowed to pass. No? He says this is a terrible velamen, this, or at least it's awe-inspiring. It's a dread velamen. That's above somewhere, that uncrossable boundary. And below there's this bottomless crypt, this deep, secret, also sacred hole. And our life, human life and thought, have to move always. They can't cross that velamen, they can't go into the crypt, because life and thought are forbidden still to cross those dim, dread bounds. These are guardian darknesses. They're silent, they're formidable, they're powerful, and they are empowered to circumscribe, to keep a limit, drawn around the wingless spirit in the boundaries of mind and ignorance. But now, when the deity rends its fence, then all these powers and darknesses no longer can protect this dual eternity, this eternal dualities. They just vanish, rescinding, giving up their enormous roles, so that this expanding zero, which was once the image or the figure, the boundary of this vain, futile ellipse of the creation, it also vanishes, it loses its giant curve. The rules change completely when the imprisoned deity escapes from its magic fence.
The old adamantine vetoes stood no more. Overpowered were earth and nature's obsolete mood. The python coils of the restricting law could not restrain the swift arisen god. Abolished were the scripts of destiny. There was no small death-hunted creature more. No fragile form of being to preserve from an all-swallowing immensity. The great hammer beats of a pent-up world heart burst open the narrow dams that keep us safe against the forces of the universe. The soul and cosmos faced as equal powers. A boundless being in a measureless time invaded nature with the infinite. He saw and had unwalled his titan's scope.
On page 18, Shobindo describes our world. A jail is this immense material world. Across each road stands armed a stone-eyed law. At every gate, the huge, dim sentinels pace. A gray tribunal of the ignorance, an inquisition of the priests of night. In judgment sit on the adventurer soul, and the dual tables and the karmic norm restrain the titan in us and the god. Pain with its lash, joy with its silver bribe, guard the wheels circling immobility. A bond is put on the high-climbing mind, a seal on the too large, wide-open heart. Death stays the journeying discoverer life. Thus is the throne of the inconscient safe, while the tardy coilings of the eons pass. And the animal browses in the sacred fence, and the gold hawk can cross the skies no more. But now for King Aswapati, none of that applies anymore. The magic, the deity, the imprisoned deity, has rent through that magic fence, and the barriers have all crashed, and the guardian darknesses have had to give up their role. So all these old adamantine vetoes, these firm decrees that no, you can't, this all are overpowered. The old rule of earth and nature, which dominates us for so long, have become obsolete for him. And that those, he says, are like the coils of a python, a very big, powerful, constricting snake. It holds you tight, crushes you. But that those python coils, they can't restrain that swift arisen God, the divine power that has broken out of all the limitations. And so all his personal limitations also disappear. There was no small death-hunted creature anymore, no little small human egoistic being, no fragile form of being to preserve from an all-swallowing immensity. There's something in us that fears that all-swallowing immensity of the universe, no? And the feeling that, oh, what will happen if the walls break in? Well, what will happen is that the divine being will just fly free above all the crashing barriers. He experiences it like a huge heart that's been pent up, compressed. Now it's beating so powerfully that it bursts open all these narrow little dams that keep us safe against the forces of the universe. So the soul, the individual soul, can face the universe as equal powers. He experiences himself as a boundless being inhabiting a measureless time. He can bring the infinite into nature, so he sees all his immense possibilities. Unpathed, there's no prescribed way, there's no walls, there's no barriers. He sees his vast, superhuman scope, range of possibility.
This passage reminds me of my getting caught in the rain last night when I was struggling. Go down the road, I thought, wonder if it was the end of me. But the
all-swallowing immensity.
Yeah, and it was, but it's interesting here, see, it's like the beats of the heart are what make you know that you're still there, you're still alive. In the midst of all that, you can keep hold of the heartbeat. Yeah, it's marvelous.
But this is a world heart. Mother has spoken about this, no? After she had her great experience in April 1962, said these beats of the world are so powerful. This is what is keeping everything going.
So actually what Sri Aurobindo describes about the guardians of darknesses, etc., it reminds me kind of the Archons, what the Greeks.
Yes.
The powers of the Archontic. So there's a strong relation.
Yeah, they of course they knew about these things
that
keep you down.
If we can realize that what's in us is this one with what's outside, those tremendous forces we also carry inside us. Usually we feel separate from it, not that's why we get scared when things get wild.
I feel also what is described in the last part, it makes so clear why it's needed the rustless and love,
to set you free. Right. So we'll read on next time about his Titan scope. What are the new experiences that are awaiting King Aswapati next? We can listen to Mother reading some passages from these sections. Shri Aurobindo.